You are now joining the Mandalorian Watch.
That's right, baby, we're back!
Just clipped everybody's speakers right out the gate, but that's fine because there is too much unbridled energy in this stream right now to contain it.
Gosh.
Look, there's going to be mic clipping in this episode, y'all. It's the Chapter 5 breakdown for the Book of Boba Fett, but it's actually just the Mandalorian.
That's exactly right. So I'm your host, Alex Maxwell, and joining me as always is...
Mac Lacey.
I can't wait to talk about this episode.
Holy moly. I just want to say off the bat, I love Star Wars. It's cool and fun and gives us great things.
Yes.
A lot of the time. So
nothing else in the world would have me standing up at 5 a.m. Like, I'm just literally standing up. I couldn't sit anymore. I had to stand up and stare in front of my TV literally for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Just standing.
My eyes started at like a sleepy kind of squint looking at the TV because I watched it at about 4 in the morning or 4:30 in the morning or so.
Yeah.
And they just kept getting wider and wider. And wider with every line of dialogue, with every new scene, I was just like, we're doing it, huh?
We're really going here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, this episode, obviously, you're getting the vibe that we loved it, and we did. We love this episode. And I can't wait to break everything down. So that's what we do. We are Children of the Watch. We were formerly The Mandalorian Watch, where we did scene-by-scene breakdowns for every single episode of The Mandalorian, and then voicemail hotline episodes. And now we're doing it for all live-action television shows. But it looks like The Mandalorian's back, so we're super excited about that. And this was just so much fun. Like, I had so much fun watching this and interacting with everybody. I know there were some people who had some criticism, and we'll talk about that as we get into it. But it was nice to see everyone, for the most part, really just celebrating what was a love letter to Star Wars. And so that was really cool to see over on Twitter, which you can follow us at COTWatch. Also on Instagram at COTWatch. And then we had a lot of fun on the Discord today, which is our Patreon Discord, which you can join for $2 a month. You can get access to bonus voicemail hotline episodes and the Discord. And that's patreon.com/TheMandalorianWatch. And so today was just so much fun, Mac. Like,
yes.
When I was at work, I was just grinning like an idiot.
Yeah.
To everyone. I was in such a good mood, and I guess it's, I don't know what that says about me that one episode of Star Wars can do that to me, but this is not hyperbole when I say this might be my favorite Star Wars.
There is definitely an argument to be made for me as well.
I'm really bad about recency bias.
Right, of course.
But like this, I had so much fun. I mean, number one, obviously, we love The Mandalorian, but I love episode one of Star Wars, you know, like, and so it's like a celebration of just kind of like everything that really just speaks to like me as a Star Wars fan. I felt like this episode was created just for me. And like, I know a lot of other people felt that way too. And it was just such a, just a fun time watching Star Wars again that honestly I hadn't felt since Luke Skywalker in The Mandalorian. You know, like, as much as I've loved the Book of Boba Fett, it's not reached this level until today, right?
Right.
So I can't wait to break it all down because there is so many details in this episode that we got to talk about.
I'm sure everything that we could say up top is going to come out in the breakdown. So I think we just spare no more time. Let's get right into it.
Let's do it. So the writer of this episode, of course, is Jon Favreau, and the director is Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yes.
Every single episode she has directed, she has brought it.
Yes. All of her episodes in every season, it's been a standout episode in one way or another, you know? So Chapter 4, The Sanctuary, I think that was...
Season 1 of The Mandalorian.
Right. Yep. Sanctuary was like the heart of that first season, honestly. It was that really important emotional foundation that just enhanced the rest of the events of the season. And then, you know, in season two, we got Bo-Katan, and that was such a big Eris, episode with her. Like, yeah, it was...
incredible.
Yeah, just... So, but this is another... Bryce Dallas Howard can direct anything in Star Wars she wants, as far as I'm concerned.
One, I would almost at this point prefer her to just direct all of season three of The Mandalorian.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, like, honestly.
Yeah, she hadn't missed yet, in my opinion. So.
Her, Rick Fiamuya, and that's... We're good. All right. So I think we're good. So yeah, she just brought it this episode. So let's jump into chapter five. We begin in a butcher shop, and a Klaatuian butcher cleaves a piece of meat while others hang huge hunks of meat on racks. I'm getting very Gotham vibes from the get-go.
I thought Rocky was going to be training in here.
Yeah. And we focus on an entryway with a strip curtain door, and we begin to push in on it, and a silhouette appears, and it's our guy, the Mandalorian.
Din himself. At this moment, I was like, we are just going right into it. I thought it would be the end of this episode, maybe at the soonest, you know? But we just went right there, and I loved it. I was like, well, this is what I wanted anyway. So
yeah, and the thing is like, oh, so we're going right there. That means he'll probably do this mission and then be on Tatooine immediately after this.
Right. I thought he, at the end of this scene, he was going to get the call.
Yeah.
And then he was going to go meet up with Boba Fett and Finnick.
No.
And nope. So much more to ground to cover.
Oh, yeah. This truly was like... an extra episode of The Mandalorian, and I'm still buzzing off of that.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Really, the only solid criticism I have of this episode at this juncture, I'm sure more will arise as I rewatch it and everything like that. No piece of media is perfect, you know?
Right.
Close. my biggest criticism at this point is just like, this is in this show. Okay. seems strange, like just pacing wise, you know?
Yes. On the surface, it is kind of strange and weird, but honestly, I don't care.
No, like, I don't either.
It was so good, like, it didn't bother me or anything like that. Normally, something like that probably would bother me, but it was just so well done and so well directed, and just, we got so much out of this. It didn't bother me. I guess my only criticism would be, is I have so many friends who kind of just dropped and stopped watching The Book of Boba Fett early on.
Mm.
If they don't see this episode, I feel like they're missing out on the Mandalorian story, because they definitely love watching The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
And so, like, if Disney could find a way of maybe, like, a week before season three comes out, add that to the Mandalorian page.
I think that'd be a fantastic idea. Yeah.
Because, it gives you some good info of, like, oh, okay. And then if they didn't watch The Book of Boba Fett, then they can go back and watch the whole show before The Mandalorian comes out.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great idea. Yeah. An easy way to kind of remedy that problem. But
right. Yep. So, yeah, he enters slowly and walks by the butchers as they watch. And immediately I'm looking at his belt, right? Like, is he wearing the darksaber? And he is. And I'm just like, oh, man, I cannot wait for this. And Din walks through another strip curtain door. And at the table sits a Klaatuian boss, and he's surrounded by his cohort. And the boss says that Din looks lost, and he announces he's here for Cabba Baez. The boss asks why he thinks he's there, and then Din pulls out a tracker. It's blinking red, and the boss asks what he wants with him, and Din tells him that he owes someone important money. And the boss goes on to ask more questions, and they have this back-and-forth exchange, and he says, well, if I see him, I'll let you know. And then Din sets down a bounty puck and turns it on, and then the boss's face appears.
It's
he
him,
is Cabba.
Obviously.
Yeah. And he claims that that's not him. It doesn't even look like him. And the others begin surrounding Din. And Cabba tries to talk his way out of it. But Din finally says, I can bring you in warm or I can bring you in cold.
And at this moment, my spine is tingling. I'm like, oh, he said it. He said it.
He's serious on this one.
Yep.
His hands begin to inch towards his blaster, but he's suddenly bitten by one of the thugs, causing him to drop the blaster. And he headbutts one of the thugs, and they all begin opening fire on him. And as he's taking fire, blaster bolts are dinging off his Beskar. And then Mac, he unclips his dark saber.
He sure does.
And he ignites it. Holy cow.
Yeah.
This whole scene, I was just, my jaw dropped.
Right. Just like, some of the big questions we had coming out of season two were like, what is Din's kind of attitude going to be towards the Darksaber and kind of the legacy, the path that comes with it, you know? Yeah. Like, what's his relationship going to be with that? I honestly was like, even during this fight, I was like wondering if he was even going to pull it. You know, like, yeah. if he would even use that in a normal scenario. And he does. And I love how he's clumsy with it.
Yes.
'Cause he would be, right?
Yes. And we're going to talk about that a lot, obviously, when the armor and Din train with it. But I love that it feels like the Darksaber has weight to it, right?
Yes. Something that, we used to have an understanding of, and I don't necessarily think we have it in the current canon, but it used to be that, like, one of the reasons only Force users wielded lightsabers was actually because, like, they become super heavy when they're ignited for whatever mm-hmm. reason. And, like, users would actually have to, like, augment their strength with the Force to be able to kind of control a lightsaber and everything like that.
Right.
So I love that we're getting that, but in a way that Din can also interact with. Like, he's right. not going to be using the Force, you know, to augment his strength, but he can learn the philosophical principles behind using the Force, and that will aid him in the use of the
Darksaber.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in the training scene, right. but yeah.
I just love it. So, like, he's clumsy with it, like you said. He slices through these guys, and at one point it's so heavy, he actually burns his leg with it. So, yep. like, it's kind of a, it's obviously helpful, but if he's not careful, it's dangerous to him as well.
Yeah.
And just the brutalness and the quietness that people wanted from Boba, mm-hmm. I think they're getting that in Din.
Yeah, Boba has proven to have much more of a warm personality than we ever right. thought. But Din is kind of stepping into that role. Like, obviously, he has a massive tender side when it comes to sure. Grogu and everything like that. So he's never, like, the old understanding of Boba Fett in that way.
Right.
But in the way that he conducts his business, he absolutely is. Because he right. is all about his goal. Whatever that is, no one's standing in his way.
Not at all.
And it's not a second thought, you know?
Yeah. And so, like, he slices through these guys. Din stabs Cabba with a vibro knife, slams him down on the table, and then he just cuts him right in half. And Clatooian emerges and he runs out, and then outside they can hear Din cut Cabba's head off.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what's so, I guess, strange to me, and it does feel like this is almost like a different series, this whole episode, because, like, everything before this has been kind of safe with yeah. Boba and the way he's been fighting, right? Like, the brutalness that we saw in The Mandalorian from Boba has kind of been absent a little bit.
Yeah.
But man, Din is just absolutely bringing it with the Darksaber. And I think it's to show just how effective the Darksaber can be.
Yeah. It does a few things. I like that character trait in Din. Not that I think that's, like, a cool or admirable thing necessarily,
no, yeah.
but I like that it sets up those tender moments and those attachments he does have, and kind of adds that gravitas to those, you know?
Yeah, he's a layered person.
Right, yeah.
Right.
More so than it seems like Boba, it has a lot going on now, especially right. you know, now that we've gotten this series, but it's a little more what you see is what you get. You know, it's a less nuanced
right.
character study, in my opinion, just so far.
Right. So Din walks out with Cabba's wrapped up head. Mm-hmm. He announces to the workers that he wants no trouble with any of them, and there's a pile of New Republic credits that they can all have if he just passes.
Mm-hmm.
And they wisely decide to take that path, and then Mando limps past the camera, and we cut to black. The Book of Boba Fett, Chapter 5, Return of the Mandalorian, and like his music plays and stuff. It's just like, I just was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. But at this point, I'm still sitting in my seat. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm still sitting in my seat. I haven't raised to my feet and walk towards my TV like I'm a 5-year old and just stand there with my mouth agape yet.
Because at this point, we assume that we're cutting right to Boba and Fennec. Yeah. And nope.
Yeah. Nope. What we do is we actually open up on a ring space station that's basically Halo.
It reminded me a lot of Halo with the ring thing. The physics and, like, I haven't wrapped my mind around that space station yet. I'll say that.
It's not a full ring. If you're watching it, it kind of stops at a certain point. And obviously, they've been saving up their CGI budget for this episode, Mac. But it kind of ends in an open loop that allows the sunlight to pass over the half ring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so it's like always going night to day, like very quickly. I don't know. It's one of the coolest new locations that we've seen in Star Wars, honestly.
Yes.
Since the prequels.
Yeah. I got like, it was kind of like Terrace vibes from KOTOR in a way where it felt like this like metropolis that also had a seedy element to it, you know?
Have you ever played the Mass Effect games?
I have not. It's a massive blind spot for me.
So it felt like something out of Mass Effect too, like the Citadel part of it. And those who played the game will know what I'm talking about. But this whole thing gave me like new, like, okay, I've seen this in other things, but not in Star Wars yet. And it's really cool to see it in Star Wars, like the Star Wars take on that idea. Yeah. And I just love this place. I hope we go back to it one day, and I hope we kind of get more history on it. And obviously in the books and comics and stuff, we can learn more about it too. But this half ring place is very, very cool. Yeah. And then
unnamed at the moment, right?
Unnamed at the moment.
I'm sure we'll get a StarWars.com blurb on it or something soon.
Yeah. There was in the EU, there was this place called The Will, but again, this isn't a complete loop, so I don't know if this is that supposed to be that same place, but this place is very cool, and we come down on Din, who is in a nighttime portion of the ring, and he limps along, and I'm just loving this place, and he walks towards a turbo lift where an alien enters, and Mando enters alongside with the severed head in his hand, and the alien looks at Din, but looks away when Mando looks back at him, and then Din exits into a bar. And I just love little scenes like this. The ambiance was really cool. Like, it didn't feel rushed.
Right.
Like, it was just kind of nice to see everything and be there and feel it.
Right. You kind of feel what Din, like, it makes you understand what Din is feeling, searching for what he is ultimately searching for. And, like, the fact that he's got that limp going on, this just kind of determined trudge, you know? yeah, I liked it. It was a nice just kind of feeling in that moment.
Yeah, and so Din exits into a bar, and to his left is a blue Ishi Tib alien, and he sits at a table surrounded by more aliens. And so as the credits rolled, I kind of waited to see if they named this character or not. But they call him like the Ishi Tib guild member or guild boss. So I guess he is the bounty hunter's guild boss on this place.
Yeah, so he's Greef Karga, but right. Yeah.
Exactly. So he says, "That was fast. You're a good hunter." And Din wants the info he was promised, and he wants to know where it, in quotation marks, is immediately. But the Ishi Tib keeps trying to get Din to sit and enjoy a meal with him, and Din doesn't have time for any of it. And he wants to know where the closest access shaft to the substrata is. And the alien is coy, wanting another job out of Mando. And then Din says he can take the head and get the info from someone else. But finally, the Ishi Tib alien gets the information to him. He says, "It's down Klozok Alley by the heat vent towers." And so Din sits the head down, and he's got things to do. He's got people to meet, and he just marches through the bar once again and enters another turbo lift, and it descends slowly. And he looks down at the burn on his side while he's in there, And then he walks through an industrial hallway when he gets out. And again, I just got to say, I love the vibe of this place. Like how there's like some exposed area and you see space. And it kind of reminded me like, man, we've been on Tatooine the entire time of this show. And we've not been off of it. And so it's kind of cool to see something else.
Yeah. One of our listeners at some point, I can't remember if it was through a voicemail or the Discord or a YouTube comment or something like that, but they were like, do you think we're going to see a star in this Star Wars?
Well,
and we have now.
So he switches over to Mando Vision and immediately sees Mandoa symbols pointing the way to the cover and Mac. This is the part where I literally just stood up for the rest of the episode.
Yeah. I was like, oh, so and it was a very similar sequence of shots as we like got into the covert on Navarro. You know, they like framed the mythosaur skull in the same way. You know, it was really cool. It was a cool just like showing, you know, how things have changed now, but also are kind of still the same.
I just a side note, if sales go down at Galaxy's Edge, a good way to boost that would to add like a covert at Galaxy's Edge where there's clues and symbols that lead you to it.
Yeah.
That would be incredible.
Yeah. They're always trying to do like AR experiences, so you could have to get your phone out and start scanning for the symbols, you know?
That would be incredible.
Yeah.
So, if you're listening, Disney executives, talk that through.
That would be a really dope speakeasy idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be really cool. Mando follows the glyphs down the access shaft, and he nearly falls but regains his footing until he's finally down on the dark side of the ring world, and he walks down a catwalk, and at the end of the catwalk, Mac, is your favorite character.
The Armorer!
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Okay, so we interviewed Emily Swallow literally this time last year, and she knew about this when we were talking about... She didn't tell us, but she knew all about this.
She did. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I was so pumped. I love the armor. I love what... And I'm going to make up a great word here, all right?
Okay.
Anyone can feel free to use this. But the remystification. is that actually a word? I don't know.
It is now.
It is now. The remystification of Star Wars. The lore and just the this idea of like she's like the keeper of this sacred history. You know, it's not just what have happened to people, it's like she's the keeper of the way, you know?
Yeah.
She, like, just the lore. You get the sense that she contains, like, an entire culture within her, you know?
Yeah.
I just think she's the coolest character.
She's really cool. And, like, what I love about this whole episode, honestly, is that it picks up threads from season one of The Mandalorian that we were kind of hoping that we would get in season two a little bit. Season two added more threads, but they didn't really pick up on this one, particularly with the armorer and his covert. And so it was just nice to revisit all of this and be like, oh yeah, they haven't forgotten any of this. And it feels like it's leading to something, right? It feels important. It's like, okay, they know what they're doing.
There is finally a clear path forward. We don't know anything about what's going to happen, but we know what the goal is now for Mando season 3, which is such an exciting feeling. Okay. Like, it was just season 2. While I loved it, it felt like it was doing a lot of legwork for things to come. That we had to introduce a lot of characters, we had to shift a lot of things around, you know. Now I feel like season three of The Mandalorian is gonna be my favorite Star Wars, I think.
Oh my gosh, I cannot wait. So she's sitting there, right? She's meditating, staring out into the vastness of space, and I just kept shaking my head. I couldn't believe it, Mac. One of my favorite things about the episode is just having her there, and then also, like, Paz Vizsla. Like, they bring Paz Vizsla down, too. Just the consistency is so nice to see in Star Wars. And so Din reaches the bottom of the stairs, and he collapses. And the armorer turns her head slightly and says, tend to him. And appearing from the darkness, Paz Vizsla grabs a medipack and carries it over to Mando. And the armorer continues to kneel, staring out into space. And Paz says he wasn't sure if he would ever see Din again. And Din thanks him for saving his life on Nevarro, which we saw in Chapter 3 of Season 1 of The Mandalorian. And after Din thanks them for their sacrifice, Paz says that there's only three of them now, as he applies the Bacta to Din's burns. And then Paz says that they'll put him to work soon. So here's a question I have. Are there only three left in all of Children of the Watch, which is like their zealot cult group? They're a cult.
Yeah.
Or are there three left in that specific covert? And there's like more maybe followers in, of the Children of the Watch throughout the galaxy.
That's a fantastic question. And I think it's maybe intentionally ambiguous.
Yes.
There may be like some surprises, you know, later down the line. Like they might bring some folks in that, you know. To me, when he was saying there's three of us now, in my mind, that was from the previous two. Like Din showing back up.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, okay. So yeah, now there's three. Yep. Like not like a three left, but like we are now a tribe of three.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, which would, I don't know. It's just, and they talk about it later, but just they were talking about how like Jedi have to distance themselves from attachments, but that's the very thing that makes Mandalorians strong.
Yeah.
And I got that sense in just like, they don't, like, honestly, Din has been a problem child for the covert, you know?
No
like,
doubt.
He basically got all of them killed, you know? Yeah. Not intentionally, but just the fact that they'd welcome him back and, like,
they don't blame him for it.
Right, right. It's just like, no, this is the way. This is what we do, you know?
Yeah, that's part, I mean, we knew that going in, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, on one hand, it's like, man, I think I could be a part of this cult. And then on the other hand, it's like, boy, they use religious manipulation a lot in this cult.
They do.
Which, what cults do. Yeah. So
by definition. So.
Yeah, yeah. So the armor asks what weapon caused that wound, and Din pulls out the handle of the Darksaber, and I love how Paz stares at it. That is his family's ancestral blade. Like, Tar Vizsla was his great ancestor, forged that weapon.
Yep.
There's so much emotion with a mask in this episode, and I thought Bryce Dallas Howard just brought it with the directing. Like she angled the cameras and stuff in such a way that it's like, man, I felt what Paz felt in that moment when he was looking at the Darksaber.
Yeah, absolutely. Do we know who's in Paz Vizsla's costume? I mean, is it Jon Favreau?
It's not Jon Favreau. No, it's I don't know his name off the top of my head, but I have seen him in other stuff. He has been actually in a few episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He doesn't have a lot of speaking roles normally. He's more of like an action type guy.
Gotcha.
But you would probably recognize him if you saw him.
I gotcha.
He's a bald guy with a big beard.
Yeah. I just figured if I was Jon Favreau, I would absolutely take the opportunity to dress up. But
no doubt.
And he's also busier than I. So
yeah, no doubt would I, for sure. So the armor orders Paz to bring her the weapon, and Paz handles the weapon with great care. Like it's like an antique artifact, right?
Mm-hmm.
As the armor lays out her tools by her side, and she rises and turns and takes the saber, and she says, by the way, there's going to be a lot of dialogue that we talk about on this episode because it's all important. So she says,
every single thing is important.
She says, all this talk of the Empire, and they lasted less than 30 years. Mandalorians have existed 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
I just love it.
Yeah. Again, just like, that sense of like, yeah, this galaxy has been around for millennia and millennia, and people have been living in it for millennia and millennia. I just love how big it feels. Like, yeah.
And I love the point she made is like, listen, the Empire only lasted 30 years. We're not going to let them destroy our culture in 30 years that's lasted 10,000.
Right. And that also kind of reinforces like the need for secrecy that they feel. They're like, no, we've been here and we will be here, and we have to do what we need to do to ensure that that's the case. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So she ignites the Darksaber, and as she raises it, she asks what Den knows of the blade, and he tells her the name of it, and then she asks if he understands its significance, and he answers, Den, whoever wields it can lead all of Mandalore. And the armorer says back, if it is won by Creed, and Creed is capitalized, by the way, not the band. If it is won by Creed,
with arms wide open,
under
the moonlight.
So she says, if it is won by Creed in battle, it is said.
This hurt my voice.
It is said, one warrior will defeat 20, and the multitudes will fall before it. If, however, it is not won in combat and falls into the hands of the undeserving, it will be a curse unto the nation. And then she powers it off and then says, Mandalore will be laid to waste and its people scattered to the four winds. I got to pause again. This is like a religious, she talks like a religious leader. Like she's talking like she's speaking from the Bible. Like she's quoting prophecy.
Right. Yeah. It. And I love that. Again, it's just that remystification. Like, I love that. So the Force has always been attractive because there's lore, there's history, there's secrets, there's mysteries, there's... Yeah. And we have another outlet for that in Star Wars now. Yes, that's what I love about it so much.
It's being created again with the Mandalorians. So we had the Jedi, we had the Sith. Now we got a third option to geek out over is the Mandalorians. And I love it. Din slowly stands to his feet and says, the hilt is of a quality of Beskar I have never seen before. So even the hilt is Beskar, which I love. And then the armor goes on to say, it was forged over 1,000 years ago by the Mandalore Tar Vizsla. He was both Mandalorian and Jedi. Let me just pause and say, one of the very first episodes we've ever done on this podcast was called Mandalorian History 101, and we talk about all of this on that podcast, so if you want to go and check that out after listening to this, and you're a new listener and you haven't heard that before, definitely worth it. Also definitely worth watching Star Wars Rebels, where they talk about the Darksaber a lot, and you get this cool, like, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows mini cartoon of how Tar Vizsla made the Darksaber.
It's like a little animatic of like shadow puppets and stuff. It's cool.
I just love the idea of Tar Vizsla, and we absolutely have to see him one day, whether in cartoon, live action, movie, whatever. We've got to see him one day for sure, right?
Yes, when we go back to whatever the Old Republic series is gonna be, when we finally go back, because like the High Republic isn't even...
That's like 200 years before the Phantom Menace,
right, like the Darksaber's 800 years older almost, you know?
Right.
So whenever we go back there, we're 100% getting like the forging of the Darksaber, Tar Vizsla, everything like that.
If we don't get that in like a season 3 flashback of The Mandalorian, he's going to be in a movie.
Yeah.
No doubt. Yeah. Because they've done all the legwork of setting up, like, people know who the Mandalorians are now because of this stuff, you know, so I can't wait to see it one day. So Din says that he's actually met a Jedi, and the armor realizes that he's completed his quest then. And then she says, she goes on to say that he may join their covert as they rebuild. I will ask, so what's their mission here? And is it to find more foundlings and like just regrow Mandalorian society?
I mean, to me, it's just survival. And you have to, in order to survive, you have to make more of your
Converts.
Group, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's what I took it to mean.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I do feel like the armor is up to something else, though, too. I'm not sure what it is, but she is up to something.
There's some very suspicious lines in a minute that we'll address.
So after they say that, we get a round of "This is the way" from everyone, and I was—I even said, "Yes, this is the way."
I also said it out loud.
And she hands back the Darksaber while the camera focuses on Paz again. Just great directing here. Just love that visual storytelling. And then we swipe over and see Mando helping Paz slide the armor's forge into place. So that means they just arrived there too.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And as they set up the forge, Paz begins questioning where Din came across the Darksaber. And then Din goes on to tell him that he defeated Moff Gideon for it, and Paz asks if he killed him. And Din says that Moff Gideon was sent off to the New Republic for interrogation. And Paz thinks that death would have been justice for Gideon's atrocities. And then the armor walks in and agrees, and she walks around the forge room, and she says, "This is true. The blood of millions of our kind is on his hands." And then Din says that he should be executed for his crimes by the New Republic Tribunal. And honestly, I'm kind of surprised that Mon Mothma would still have an execution as a form of punishment in the New Republic. Because what we know of her from the Aftermath novels, she's trying to dismantle the fleet like almost immediately after the war.
Demilitarization, just to try to prevent what they're doing from becoming the Empire again, you know?
Right.
I wonder how much, like, I don't see Din keeping up with galactic politics that much.
That is true.
Know
he knows that he's very sheltered.
Yeah.
He's a very sheltered person. That is a very good point on your part. So the armor obviously doesn't believe that will happen though. You know, like she doesn't think that they'll kill Gideon. And honestly, I think Gideon will escape or get away or something.
100%.
From the New Republic.
Yeah, he'll become Thrawn's henchman or something.
Exactly.
Basically,
yeah, his right-hand man.
Yeah.
And the forge ignites and the armor starts speaking what I assume is old Mandalorian prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "The songs of eons past foretold of the Mythosaur rising up to herald a new age of Mandalore. Sadly, it only exists in legends."
Yep.
So whether this is... The thing with prophecy, obviously, is... Sometimes it could be literal or it could be figurative, right? Like it doesn't necessarily have to be literal, but that line was very intentional. And I think we'll get something along those lines in the future.
Yeah. And I think it that line speaks to maybe what the long-term end goal is for the armor, for Children of the Watch. Mandalorians love to try to take over the galaxy. I think we're going to get a Mandalorian war.
That's what you think the armor wants to do?
Yes.
Oh no.
Oh yes.
Oh no.
The way that we've kind of always understood Mandalorians, like they, especially when we're talking about the old way, like the warrior tradition of the Mandalorians, they were always trying to, like, rise up, take over whatever they could, you know. Like, I'm replaying KOTOR right now, and Kandra says, like, whether we win or lose, we get glory, and that's all we're after, you know? Like, there's glory to be had in battle, so that's just always what they do.
So not only is she probably trying to raise their numbers, but raise their numbers so that they can invade the galaxy and take it over one day again.
I think if, like, we're just talking blue sky dreams for the Armorer, it is a galaxy that is conquered
by
Mandalorians.
Oh, dang.
Just my
thoughts.
You know,
you're right, though. You're right, though, because they're committed to the old ways, and the old ways of Mandalore are take over everything and rule everything. Mm-hmm. That's the way. That is the way. When they say, this is the way, that's the way.
That is the way.
Oh my gosh. So, okay, yeah. So, okay, like we were talking about this on the Discord a little bit, and I had made the comment that maybe this kind of puts the armorer in a villainous light. And I don't want to say villain. Villain's the wrong word. And she could be an antagonist to Din.
Yes. An antagonistic force, I think, is the... Because, like, not a villain.
No.
Depending on how things go.
Yeah. Right. I could see her going to the villain route, but like not necessarily like she's not like Thrawn or Vader or anything like that, but
no.
She's
not evil, but she could be a villain.
Right.
Like I don't think she's evil. I think she's following like, you know, probably what she was raised to believe and everything, you know.
Right.
So
Yeah, we will talk about that too. Okay, so she takes out her tools and begins to question Din where he came across the Beskar spear. And he says it was a gift of the Jedi, and he takes it off to show her, and then he explains that it can block lightsabers, and that he even used it to defeat Gideon. And the dynamic also, real quick, between the armor and Din, like, she's like a mother to him, and the way he acts towards her is like, I don't imagine she's like old enough to be his mother, but like, he kind of defers to her like that.
Yeah. I mean, any kind of like small intimate group like that, like, has an authority figure like that, you know, whether it's an actual set thing or not, like, there's an obvious respect there, you know?
For sure.
Yeah.
And like, it's like he wants her approval, you know?
Yeah,
it's
100%.
Like, so she says it can also pierce Beskar armor. Its mere existence puts Mandalorians at risk, and Mandalorian steel is meant for armor, not weapons. So who made this?
That's a fantastic question. I love the parallels from Rebels with the Duchess, the Duchess weapon.
Right, that Sabine Wren made.
Right. Basically, anything that's specifically designed to take out Mandalorians is like it's like sacrilegious to
all
Mandalorians
agree to that. Like,
right.
Even Sabine's dad, who didn't even wear armor, was like, that's bad.
That's bad.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great point. So, like, I'm questioning if Mandalorians even made this. So we know Morgan Elsbeth had it in season 2 of The Mandalorian when Ahsoka fought her.
Yeah.
But she works for Thrawn. So my question is this a Jedi weapon? Did the Jedi make this? Or maybe did Thrawn make it to fight Jedi?
Yeah. That's a fantastic question. There's so many possible answers. I mean, it could be
because,
you know,
if
Thrawn
they destroyed
could've made it.
Mandalore and then took the Beskar armor, like we saw the client, Herner Wurzog's character, had just Beskar laying around.
Right. Yeah. It could be the Empire. I could also see it being, I guess it depends on how old it is, but
true.
If we don't know, I assume though, because I haven't heard contrary, the galaxy was at one point like taken over by a Sith Empire.
Yes. Right. Yes, that has happened.
So that's
Revenge
100...
of the Sith. Palpatine says once again, the Sith shall rule the galaxy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it could have been from a time like a Knights of the Old Republic type time when the Sith were also interested in fighting Mandalorians. That just doesn't seem like a Jedi thing to make to me.
You're right.
But we've seen the Jedi be very awful too. So
that is true. So I'm just saying the armor is like almost offended by its presence. It's like, we got to get rid of this. And so Din takes the spear and immediately just gives it up to her for so she can forge it into armor. And like, Din's really into this, isn't he? Like, he's a true believer of everything that they've done, which retrospectively, like when he takes off his helmet, that's a big deal.
It's a big deal. And it shows just how important the bond he has with Grogu is to him, you know? Yeah. So I like that it strengthens that. You know, like, it was, that bond was strong enough for him to overcome this other thing that he holds, you know, very near and dear.
Right. Yeah. So the armor takes it and says that the Darksaber is a more noble weapon for him to wield. And she immediately puts it into the forge as Din sits. And he asks the armor if he've ever heard of Bo-Katan Kryze. And I'm like, oh my gosh, Din, don't bring her up right now.
I know.
And that's actually something we asked Emily Swallow in her interview, is like, would they get along? And she was kind of coy about it. Now we know the answer.
Yep. No.
The armor says Bo-Katan is a cautionary tale. Mm-hmm. She once laid claim to rule Mandalore based purely on blood and the sword you now possess, but it was gifted to her and not won by creed. Bo-Katan Kryze was born of a mighty house, but they lost sight of the way. Her rule ended in tragedy. They lost their way, and we lost our world. Holy cow. She does not like Bo-Katan.
No, and that says a lot, you know, about how the armorer views things. It, in my opinion, maybe indicates that the children of the Watch are newer than maybe we suspect.
I've been thinking about that a lot. So they talk about that they're on Concordia, right? Like, yep. They are on the moon of Concordia. And that's where Death Watch was too.
That's where, so when New Mandalore took over, the pacifistic government, basically they exiled anyone who's still like literally sticking to their guns, sent them to Concordia.
It could work either way. Either Death Watch was formed first out of the Vizsla House,
right.
Or the Children of the Watch were already on Concordia, and then when everybody else was exiled, they kind of accepted them in, and then I could see Death Watch forming as an offshoot of Children of the Watch, or vice versa.
Right.
Death Watch was first, and then out of what happened in the Clone Wars and the Maul, when Maul took over, yep. Children of the Watch was formed. It could go either way.
Children of the Watch, like, right, even just the name itself, it could literally be like, oh, we are an offshoot of the Watch, meaning Death
right.
Watch. Like, we are the
children
what,
of the
what
Watch.
Death Watch birthed.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could mean, it also tells, it like speaks of kind of this lineage and this history. So it
they're
could
like
also be
watchers
to
on
back.
The wall, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
It could work as that way too. Like, we're going to watch out for the old way of Mandalore while you guys try this new way.
Yep.
Here's the thing though. There's been a lot of, I've seen a lot of people get like, say like, oh, this proves Bo-Katan is wrong and not right. It doesn't.
It doesn't. Here's the thing. What the armorer says is correct from a mm-hmm. certain point of view.
Exactly.
Right? From
exactly.
where she sits, it does look like nepotism, right?
Yes.
The Duchess's sister gets the Darksaber. It looks
right.
like a nepotism.
We should stop and explain that. Bo-Katan's
yeah.
sister was the leader of all of Mandalore during the Clone Wars. She also happened to be Obi-Wan Kenobi's girlfriend.
Yeah. yeah.
That he like struggled with that idea, but he clearly loved her and she loved him.
Right.
She brought a new way to Mandalore that's like, let's get rid of armor, let's get rid of weapons, let's become pacifists.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't like that.
Right.
Bo-Katan being one of them. Her sister,
yeah.
her own sister.
She joined Death Watch.
Right. And so Bo-Katan, when all that fell, and then Darth Maul actually took over Mandalore and he fell, there was a certain period where there was like no ruler of Mandalore. And then we saw in Rebels, Sabine Wren came across the Darksaber, and then she ended up giving it to Bo-Katan. Now,
yeah.
what we're about to hear happens after that, after Star Wars Rebels, when Bo-Katan was the, in quotations, leader of Mandalore.
Yeah. And okay. so we don't know the details of that other than
what we're
the
told
new information
in
we learn in this episode.
So let's get into it.
Let's
she lifts
it.
The burning spear into the air as she continues, and she says, "Had our sect not been cloistered on the moon of Concordia, we would not have survived the Great Purge." And the spear fades into the moon. Maybe it's Concordia. I'm not sure. Then a squadron of TIE bombers fly over Mandalore. We get live action Mandalore,
yes.
Max. And they're dropping
bubble cities and all.
They're dropping bombs on an already devastated surface of Mandalore, and mushroom clouds bubble up into the air, which makes me think they're using nuclear weapons on Mandalore.
Yeah. Or I mean whatever the galactic equivalent of.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean there were just the horrors of that scene like remind mm-hmm. me a lot of like the actual atomic bombings in
yep.
like yeah, in Japan.
Hiroshima, yeah.
Right. Just like hearing, like I took Japanese in high school, and just hearing like the horrors of how people are still feeling the effects of that today.
Yeah.
You know, like I think we are meant to understand that this is probably the worst thing the Empire could do to a planet other than the Death Star.
Right. And in some ways, maybe worse because it's still there.
Still
but
there.
It's just, you can't live in it.
Right. You don't have like that. Right. Yeah.
Right. So she narrates, those born of Mandalore strayed away from the path. Eventually, and she's talking about the pacifist there. Eventually, the Imperial interlopers destroyed all that we knew and loved in the Night of a Thousand Tears. Now, we got to stop right there because we were under the original assumption that the Night of a Thousand Tears happened during the Siege of Mandalore.
Right.
I'm under the belief now that there's two sieges of Mandalore. One that Maul did in the Clone Wars. The other one is this.
Yes. It's the Imperial conflict with with Mandalore. It's
so after Ezra and Sabine and the Rebels crew go and liberate Mandalore, the Empire came back in a big way, in a very angry way.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like the Night of a Thousand Tears almost seems like retaliation for that, you know. And I'm sure there were other conflicts leading up to it. Like Mandalore's not the easiest world to govern, right?
Right. Like, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Like if you're the Empire, you know.
Yeah, there's a reason they were still neutral even as pacifists.
Right.
In the Clone Wars. So we see one of the dome cities of Mandalore, probably Sundari, which is the capital, and it explodes into a giant mushroom cloud, and the nuclear fire incinerates everything in its path, and the Mandalorian armor seen on the ground, and the fire washes away everything, and then we get a straight up scene from the Terminator here as K2 droids march across the apocalyptic wastelands, just killing down and injured Mandalorians, and probe droids hover above them, providing lighting so that the K2 droids can see them to kill them. And it's just like, dang.
It is gnarly. The K2 units are so scary looking.
Yeah.
Very big Terminator vibes. Just a nightmare.
Just a nightmare. And so we fade back into the armor as she finishes her story, and she says, only those that walked the way escaped the curse prophesied in the creed. Though our numbers were scattered to the winds, our adherence to the way has preserved our legacy for the generation until we may someday return to our home world. Then she stops and pauses. What shall I forge? Interesting. And so Din, of course, says something for a foundling, and the armor agrees, but then Din clarifies. He says he wants this to be for a specific foundling, Grogu. And the armorer says that he's no longer in his care, but Din says he wants to see him and make sure he's safe.
Yep. I love that because it means we're going to get them back together at some point. Yep. I love that, like, Din is really struggling with this, like, separation, you know? It's just all around cool. It speaks of great things to come.
It's so cool. It also reveals that the armorer knows more about Din than Din probably realizes.
Yeah.
She's keeping tabs.
Yeah.
She knows things. She knows.
She does. She also 100% has an agenda in all of these scenes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what do you, because we haven't actually seen the item, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we might get into the description of that in just a second, but like,
What is it?
It's
got to be a piece of armor.
Chainmail looking to me.
Says, like, what is that in Lord of the Rings that Frodo wears?
Mithril.
It's like that.
Yeah.
That's what I'm imagining.
I almost wonder if because of his ears, if he's going to have like a chainmail helmet.
Oh, kind of thing. Grogu with a helmet on.
I don't know.
It could be really cute. So adorable. I love him. In the little bubble of the N1 fighter.
Yeah.
Man, I can't wait. She explains to him, the armor explains to him, that for in order to master the ways of the Force, Jedi cannot have attachments. And then Din counters and he says, well, that's the opposite of their creed. We believe exactly the opposite thing. And the armor agrees. And then the Forge montage begins once again. I love these scenes. She ties the tiny little Beskar armor into a knot that resembles Grogu's head.
Yeah.
And then we wipe away to the image of the ring, and we hear the Darksaber in the armor instructing him. She says, Solas, Tad, Een, Kerr. She repeats these words a few times as she teaches him how to fight with the Darksaber. I looked this up in Mandoa. Solas means one, Tad mm-hmm. means two, Een means three, Kerr means four, just so we're all clear.
Great. I probably could have told you that without looking it up, just because I have
I just wanted to make sure.
Done martial arts in my life, but
I just want to make sure. There is a whole Mandoa dictionary you can look up, by the way, that has a lot of words.
Yeah.
Din is really struggling when he's being taught this, even to the point where he just falls off the catwalk, and the armor tells him that he's fighting against the blade, and he flies back up with the jetpack and says that the blade is getting heavier, and she once again points out that he is fighting against the blade.
Yeah.
So instead, he needs to fight against the opponent, and she orders him to start again, but he can barely lift it. And so to me, it's like the Darksaber almost has a mind of its own.
Yeah, I don't think that's inconsistent with other lightsabers. I mean, like, kyber crystals, which I'm assuming the Darksaber is still made of some kind of kyber crystal.
It's a like, black kyber crystal.
So do we know that for sure?
I'm pretty sure. Like, it's like,
I mean, it's got to be, right?
I think it might be like almost like a Beskar kyber hybrid type thing going on. Okay. I could be making that up, but in my mind, that's what it is.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. The kyber crystals are attuned to the Force. So it's not like they're sentient, but they do react to the Force, which is made up of life, you know? So in a way, lightsabers are sort of...
alive.
Sort of, yeah. There's life in them, I will say.
So she says you can't control it with strength, and then Din stands and he asked to try again. Now, I'm going to say a line from Star Wars Rebels that I pulled called Trials of the Darksaber. There's an episode in Star Wars Rebels called Trial of the Darksaber mm-hmm. that Sabine Wren is being trained how to use the Darksaber by Kanan Jarrus, who is a Jedi.
Yes.
And this is what Kanan says when he is training her, which this would take place about 15 years before this or so, maybe 10. He says, energy constantly flows through the crystal, and he's talking about the Darksaber here. You're not fighting with a simple blade as much as you're directing a current of power. Your thoughts, your actions, they become energy. They flow through the crystal as well and become part of the blade. I think that's still consistent with what the armor is telling Din.
Yes.
Just a different way to do it.
Yeah, I love all of the lightsaber training scenes, especially the Kanan and Sabine one, and then this one are very kung fu movie. Even more so, like that was of course a big original influence on Star Wars, you know, like when Obi-Wan is training Luke, that kind of thing. But those really feel like kung fu movies. You've got the master who is really imparting this philosophical lesson, you know, via the weapon.
Yeah. I love it. So the armor goes on to say, persistence without insight will lead to the same outcome. Boy, that will preach.
Yep.
And then he's got to get his head in the game, basically. And then behind him, Paz enters and says that the Darksaber belongs in someone else's hand. And the armor doesn't stop this. Instead, she steps aside, and Paz says, it was forged by my ancestor, founder of House Vizsla. And then kind of coldly, Din replies, and now it belongs to me.
Yeah.
That's huge, because that means he wants it.
Right. That was a question. Like I mentioned that earlier. We were unsure of how Din was going to feel with that whole arrangement, you know?
Unreal.
So
unreal.
That is confirmation that, like, he at least is fond of the idea.
Yep.
You know, whether we see him wanting all that means, or if he just wants this cool weapon, you know, it could be on a couple different levels, but we'll see.
Right. So Paz wants to win it in combat, and the armor asks if he agrees, and of course he does, and she leaves as the two begin to square off. I just love it. And the first thing they do is remove the jetpacks, which is such a smart move, because we all know if a Mandalorian's wearing a jetpack, he's probably gonna die.
Right. And in this instance, I understand it's supposed to make it more deadly, but I was immediately more relieved when they took them off.
Exactly. Mando ignites the Darksaber, and Paz pulls out a vibroblade and ignites the energy shield on his gauntlet, which is really cool because we saw those in the Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels. And in the fight, Mando manages to destroy his shield, but clearly Paz is much stronger. And Din is holding his own until Paz just keeps headbutting him and then flings him like a rag doll across the catwalk. And the Darksaber goes out, and Paz jumps across to Mando and slams him against the bulkhead and then just takes the saber and ignites it. And Paz, despite his strength, can't control it either. And this allows Din to pull out his vibro knife and just make small surgical strikes to weaken Paz. And Mando manages to get behind Paz and hold the knife to his throat. And the armor announces that the fight is finished.
Yeah.
And then we get real awkward.
Uh-huh.
Now, remember, she did this back in episode 3. Chapter 3 of season 1, she does this exact same thing when Paz and Din fight.
Right.
She asks these questions. She starts asking Paz, Paz Vizsla, have you ever removed your helmet? No. Has it ever been removed by others? Never. Imagine the butt sweat Din instantly got.
Just at the first moment when she starts asking that question, just the sinking pit in his stomach, right? Knowing what he has to say.
Then she asks Din the same question, silence. She asks it again, and she reminds him by creed he must vow, and he tosses Paz down and admits to it. And then the armor then says, then you are a Mandalorian no more.
Yep.
Dang. And you can hear it in Din's voice. I beg your forgiveness. How can I atone? Yep. And Paz from behind says, leave, apostate.
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow. And then she goes on to say another very interesting thing. She says, according to creed, one may only be redeemed in the living waters beneath the mines of Mandalore. So I imagine these are Beskar mines.
That's what I would venture to say, just given the context.
Yeah, and then Din says that they all have been destroyed, and then she says this is the way to confirm.
So here's what I think.
Okay.
I think there's something buried in the collapsed mines of Mandalore that the Armorer wants.
Oh!
I think she maybe already was suspecting, at least, about the helmet thing, maybe.
She asked him knowing.
I think she's essentially trapping him into running an errand.
Oh my gosh, Mac. I love your irresponsible speculation.
I don't think she actually cares about this. I just think that she, knows that this is a way that I can for sure
manipulation
get you there and make you think it's your idea.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
And that's probably
it gets him on
worst.
Mandalore. It gets
him
on
Mandalore.
Mandalore.
That's at worst. That's if we take the worst view of the armor in this instance. In the best view, she wants Din to become Mandalore, perhaps to lead the charge to reconquer the galaxy. Or
and she's a true believer, and if the creed says it, you got to do it.
Well, even that, maybe that she knows that there's a trial in wait for Din, and she knows that he needs to go through it in order to be ready to assume that role.
Interesting.
So there's
okay,
a,
so
there's
that's
a
giving her the benefit of the doubt, right?
Right. That's if you take the most altruistic view of the armorer in that.
And
moment.
It could be either way. It could be either way, and that's what I love about it. And so Mando hangs his head, his shoulders slump. Everything, his whole world is now gone. Everything is gone from him.
Yep. Grogu's gone.
Exactly.
That was the first loss. Mm-hmm. Now he even lost, he lost his found family. Now he's losing his
actual family.
Still
his new
found
family.
Family.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Older found family.
So he marches towards his jetpack, crosses by the armorer. She doesn't even look back at all. Ice water in those veins. Mm-hmm. Is she upset? Is she disappointed? I can feel the disappointment coming off of Din. Knows he's disappointed her, and he's sad about it.
Right. Here's why I think the armorer is doing it on purpose. They don't try to take the Darksaber.
Yes, that's. I noticed that too.
I think there's a point to all of that.
You could say like, well, they didn't beat him in combat, but I feel like if he's not a Mandalorian any longer,
they would have just killed him and taken it, right?
You imagine
if they actually, if everything was exactly as they were saying.
Right, because it's like, I'm sure they did not consider Maul or Moff Gideon Mandalorian, but they weren't in a position to take it from him.
Right.
And they could have with Din.
Right.
Yep. So Mando leaves back up towards the ring, and leaving behind the family that raised him on the ring world, a Starliner comes alongside it, and Mando's going to go to Tatooine, and he's stopped at a security checkpoint, and an REX droid stops him, Rex droid,
yep.
from Star Tours. He has too many weapons, and once again, Din says that he's a Mandalorian and weapons are part of his religion. He said that back in Chapter 2 of The Mandalorian, so it's not hyperbole.
No.
That is really part of the creed.
Right.
It is a religious thing. And reluctantly... Says, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, he's like, I know everything that's in here.
Yeah, I love this.
This is such a serious and like mind-blowing episode in some ways, and it's also the funniest we've ever seen Din in a couple different situations, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and like I love like how he's just taking off all the weapons one by one. It takes him forever.
Right.
And like you said, he tells the droid he knows everything that's inside, and then he boards. And then later the ship leaves, and Mando sits alone with his jetpack beside him, and he's looking out into the stars. I'm sure he's thinking about Grogu.
Mm-hmm.
And then a Rodian child is staring at him from the seat in front of him, and he waves at him.
Yeah.
And of course, again, I'm sure this reminds him of Grogu too. Like, he's little, he's green.
Right.
And then the mother tells him to sit, right? We've all been on a plane and that has happened to you, right?
Yeah. I'm like, yeah we've all ridden the bus. Like, I love that we get a glimpse of public transit in Star Wars. It's
Me
something
too.
We don't get often, you know? Everybody's flying their own private cars.
Now, I will say, like, this scene is like kind of heartbreaking, because like when the kid sits back down, Mando head droops and he pulls out the bundle to look at it again as Grogu's music plays.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see the Starliner soar down to Mos Eisley Tatooine, and it lands, and Mando exits retrieving his crate, and the REX droid sounds like Dio. Did you notice that? Like the voice kind of sounds like Dio a little bit from Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah.
And then we cut to another surprise of this episode. After he gets his weapons, we cut to a BD unit droid walking into view. And so this droid model is from Jedi Fallen Order.
Mm-hmm.
If this is BD-1 or not, we're not sure. Like, that could be the exact same droid. I doubt it.
I think it's just like a BD unit.
But all I know is if I had a droid, this is the type of droid I'd have.
So cute.
I love this droid.
Yeah.
If like Grogu needs a few episodes off, Mando just needs to take BD with him everywhere he goes, because
everybody gets their cuteness. And,
So then a Womp Rat jumps out and takes it in his mouth while Pelly Motto tries to shoot it from behind, and the other droids follow behind to see, but the pit droids are all scared to save poor BD, and then Pelly approaches it, and then we get a scene from Alien reenacted for us as the Womp Rat drags her down.
Yep.
And then the droids just watch. They're just watching, but thankfully Mando arrives and blasts the Womp Rat, and BD is okay, thank God.
Yep.
And she begins asking why he's there, but then Mando says that he got her message. She said she found him a replacement for the Razor Crest. and she asks if he has the cash, and he gives it to her, and then she walks him towards the new ship. But first she wants to know where Grogu is, and he tells her, and she says that they could have made money off of him by opening up a petting zoo for him, and I think she's right about that.
Yep.
And then they approach...
Grogu petting zoo would do really well in the real world.
Oh, no doubt. They approach the ship, and even under the sheet, you can tell it's an N1 starfighter, and those are the starfighters from Episode 1, The Phantom Menace.
Man, I love this design. This was the first, like, Star Wars ship toy I had, was an N1.
Mm, yep, I had one of those too, yeah.
Just like a, you know, you could, like, drop one action figure into, you know?
Yep.
And so, yeah, I have very fond memories of it. Phantom Menace was one of the first movie I remember going to see in the theater, and I had, you know, I was all bought into the hype and everything. So I've got very fond memories, yeah, you know, behind this design.
I agree. Like the Phantom Menace for me, I was 9 when it came out, so like it hit me at the peak age for me to fall in love with Star Wars. So Episode 1 is like very special to me personally.
Yeah.
And so to see this kind of stuff, it moves me. Like I'm moved by seeing some of the stuff. And I know there's people who don't like the prequels, and I understand that. But to give credit where credit is due, Doug Chang designed a lot of these starships, and he intentionally made them look different than what we had seen before in yes. the original Star Wars. And I think that was such a bold take.
Yeah, motivated by events in the story. Everything yeah. was curvy, and then the Empire took over, and everything got chunky. That's just kind of how it worked.
Love it. Love it. And she asked, are you ready to have your mind blown? And I'm like, that was kind of to the audience a little bit. Yeah. Din doesn't understand because he thought she had another Razor Crest, but instead she says she has a replacement for it, but he is not impressed. And she says, do you have any idea what this is? This is an N1 starfighter handmade for the Royal Guard and commissioned personally by the Queen of Naboo.
Yep.
Padme.
Yep. Well,
Maybe.
It could have been any of the other queens, you know. But
true. I'm going with Padme.
Also, let's remember that that means a child commissioned it, because they only elect child queens.
Yeah, she is 14.
Naboo's governance system, I have never
They got
never
a lot
understood.
Of trust. Listen, I teach middle school. I'm not electing them to lead us.
No.
Love them. Not electing them to lead us at all. So Din wants his money back, but as the droids go and get the money, she tries to sell it to him one more time, and she asks if he knows how hard it is to find all these parts that were made during the Galactic Republic. This is interesting. This is kind of interesting. She says that they were handmade, not by droids.
Yeah, and that's why she selected it, because she knew it was interesting, because that idea is carried over from, you know, The Mandalorian. But then later, we also understand kind of what we were seeing, that his attitude towards that is changing. So I like right. that we, like, even in this moment, if you just examine it under a microscope, you can see kind of evidence of that shift in character, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So she also says that she's going to add in some modifications that will make her faster than a Falthier, which is from The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
And since it's pre-Empire, it's off the grid. And then Mando agrees that she can put it together before he decides, and it would be a lot faster if he helped. And then we cut to a scene of Mando and BD working on the ship, and then Pelly returns with a part that will make his ship the fastest in the Outer Rim. And it came from the Jawas. And by the way, as they're talking about how the Jawas find these things, watch BD in the Scurrier when you rewatch it, because they have this whole little other thing going on, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah. I love a multitasking scene.
Yeah, and so Mando wants to know if he can meet them, the Jawas, and she calls for them, and then as they're coming, she says that she dated a Jawa once. They're very furry, very furry. And Mando says that all the parts he needs, which is just Star Wars gobbledygunk, like he's just saying things that
the Star Wars words in this episode, it's peak Star Wars words. They were just, I don't think there was a script for that whole scene. I think they were just saying, like, they were just saying stuff.
The manifold, like, compressor to take it to the, I don't know.
Right.
So, but the point is from the scene is that Mando knows his stuff, right? Like he yes. knows shop. He can talk shop.
Right.
And then we cut to a montage scene. They love montage scenes. Jon Favreau, a huge mm-hmm. fan of it. And then Pelly says what at first sounds like a throwaway line during this, but it might not be. She says that she's never been off world and she's a local gal.
Yeah.
That's an interesting line. I don't know if we need to know that and file it away for later. Because, like, I could see a point where she just becomes the new mayor of Tatooine somehow.
Yeah.
So, I could see something like that.
I would vote for Pelly.
Me too. Oh, that's a good shirt idea.
Vote for Pelly.
So, it's like vote for Pedro, but instead. Yeah. She says that he has that Fast and Furious turbo engine now too, which is really cool. And then BD also helps Mando fit the paneling on the ship and celebrates with a cute little dance when he helps Mando.
Yeah.
And then Mando still wants a Razor Crest, but I agree with Pelly. I think this is much better than a Razor Crest.
I think he's looking at that single cockpit. And I think he's maybe thinking about how he'd have a hard time fitting a little dude in there.
Oh, you can't raise Grogu in an N1 starfighter, Mac.
I think that's the motivation behind kind of what, you know, why he kept bringing it up.
Straight to the heart. Yeah. Oh, man. And then we learn the name of the pole that Han used to try and stop the trash compactor.
Yep.
This is a cryogenic density combustion booster.
Yep. I really am super glad that I have that to finally be able to specifically refer to that long bumpy thing that they braced the walls of the trash compactor with.
Then Din wants to know where they got it from, and they learn that they stole it from a Pike spice runner. Now we're finally coming back to the Book of Boba Fett.
I was like, oh, right, we're not watching The Mandalorian, actually.
Right, right. And then Pelly says, let me tell you something. Pikes do not mess around. Ever since they've been moving spice through the system, everything has gone to hell. Everyone's afraid of them, and law enforcement won't even go near them. Does Cobb Vanth count as law enforcement?
Great question.
I don't know.
I think he probably considers himself law enforcement.
But nobody else does.
I don't know if anybody else does. I don't know.
Timothy Oliphant, by the way, me and my wife are rewatching Justified.
Mm.
He's just Cobb Vanth in the real world in that show. So if you're needing some Cobb Vanth, watch Justified.
Fair enough.
So back to the show. Din pays them for the part, which is nice to see.
Yeah,
then we
especially
cut,
how many Jawas he took out
killed.
With just reckless abandon.
He's grown.
Yeah, I love it.
So Jawas took apart his first ship. Now they're helping him build his second one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Full circle.
All's
then
right.
we cut to dawn, and a dinosaur crows at sunrise.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, it's a dragon rooster.
That is the perfect name for it. Dragon Rooster.
Dragon Rooster.
And then from out of the shadows, the N1 fighter emerges. It's mostly silver with a few hints of yellow.
And I love that they kept just a few hints of the yellow. I think it looks dope. I'm not going to lie. So this was something that you and I...
We knew.
Kind of had potentially known that it was coming up, right?
Yeah.
I was... needing to see it. I was like, I just need to see Din next to it, and I'll know how I feel about it. I'm into it. I love
so
it.
Good.
I think it's the design's great. I love the hot rod motor. What really got me about this scene, Bryce Dallas Howard grew up in, like, playing in the background of meetings between Ron Howard and George Lucas. Do you know what both of those dudes love?
Hot rods.
I mean, just like from American Graffiti. It's just the ethos that's coming through. Just Star Wars always wears its influences on its sleeves. This is no exception. Just so good. It makes me want to cut my hair into a pompadour and start working on some old car.
Get a leather jacket.
Yep.
Dude, this whole scene... had me just like, the first half of the episode had me like feeling some kind of way about Mandalorians and Mandalore and like deepening my love for Star Wars in a brand new way. And then this was just like, hey, you remember episode one and all the things that were great about that movie? Let's celebrate that right now.
Yeah.
And I love that. So Mando... he circles it. He's checking out the chrome plating. He asks about the droid port, and she hollowed it out since she doesn't care. He knows that he doesn't care for droids, which has kind of changed a little bit, but she doesn't know that. And then Grogu will be in that little bubble, right? There's no doubt about
100%.
It.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, okay.
In his little chainmail armor.
Yeah.
Aww, yeah. So Mando comes around the tail of the ship, and you can tell he likes it. So do I. And he asks Peli if the ship is ready, and she says to start her up. And then Mando climbs in, powers it up. Have I mentioned how much I love episode one?
Yeah.
The ship sounds like a muscle car.
It does. It's got like that really low rumble.
Yeah. And then Mando closes the canopy and it takes off, and the graphics are incredible in this scene. He takes it over the city. It sounds like a pod racer.
Yes.
And yeah,
you've got, so this was great because you've both got kind of the throwbacks of pod racing. It felt, especially with the way that the N1's engines look, it almost looks like a pod racer. It's essentially the same shape, right? So just like jumping in and out of the canyons and everything. And then we bring it full circle to just like Beggar's Canyon back home. You know, so
it goes right into it.
Right. I love that those two things can exist in the same world and it's all good. And
it's just a celebration of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which is what I love. So Peli tells him like, hey, you're flying it like the Razor Crest. Fly this like a starfighter. Because that's what it is. And so he puts the pedal to the metal and he flies right into Beggar's Canyon, which is through the Bunta Eve classic, right? That's the pod racing place that we saw in episode one. And I just love it so much. And then he wants to really test it and he pulls back the yoke and he rockets up to space and he passes the Starliner and the Rodian child looks out to see it. And Mando gives the kid a nod and then shoots away, dipping in and out over the cruiser. And he tries spinning it because that's a neat trick. And then the two...
it took me a second. I'm so sorry.
But then the two X-Wings pull up beside Mando, saying he's flying too fast beside a commercial ship, and he's flying without a beacon.
Yeah.
This pilot... Yeah, go ahead.
It's just classic Hot Rod movie, right?
It is. Like, these are the cops, right? Like, pull over. What are you guys doing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is exactly what's happening. So this guy, this... X-Wing pilot is named Lieutenant Reed in the credits. And he's played by Max Lloyd Jones, which he was an actor in the Planet of the Apes movies.
Gotcha.
He was also the double for Luke Skywalker, I think.
Okay. Gotcha.
So who basically did all the moves and stuff. So, which is cool. So they notice the ship is very modded out, and so they want to see the registration, but Mando doesn't have it. So they ask for a ping, and he hasn't set up the transmitter yet. So like he's giving every excuse in the book, and the pilot says,
"I'm gonna go right back. I'll get it started. It'll be all good."
Yeah. Yeah. So the pilot says he needs to relinquish control so they can take over. But then the other pilot interrupts and it's a familiar voice.
It is.
He says that they can just let him off with a warning this time. And Mando says, thank you. But then Carsa Teva stops him. Mm-hmm. He says his voice sounds familiar to him. And he asks if he used to have a Razor Crest. And he brings up the incident at Navarro. And Teva wants to ask him about his entanglements with the Imperial Remnant. And looks over to see Mando in the cockpit. Now, I do want to say, while it appears that Teva is just kind of being annoying to him, I do think Carson Teva doesn't want to, like, burden him in any way. I think he truly wants to ask about what's going on with the Empire.
I think he is thankful. And he is... Because, I mean, like, the Empire is gone from Navarro.
Mm.
You know, after the events of season one and two... Mm. So, like, to me, it seemed like he was, like, trying to make sure. He was like, are you the same guy? And, like, are you kind of who I have to thank for my job being way easier lately?
So, for some reason, I feel like it's, like, Carson Teva has information on the Empire, and he needs to talk to Mando about it. And it's one of those situations that, like, Mando doesn't want to talk to him because he's, like, the authorities, right? Like,
right.
But it's like, if they just sat down and talked, they could actually help each other a lot.
Hmm.
That's what I think. Because remember what he said to Cara Dune in season two when he gave the Marshall badge to her? He said, something's happening out here in the Outer Rim, and I think he's onto it.
Yeah. Do you think any of this was set up for anything Rangers of the New Republic?
Maybe.
And then
maybe
it's not going to go anywhere because We're not getting that show anymore, right?
Don't know.
Gotcha. Just haven't heard anything.
Yeah. Doesn't seem like it, but maybe. We'll see. Yeah. So basically, he looks over to see Mando in the cockpit. Mando looks at him, and then he does the Fast and Furious thing and speeds away at amazing speeds.
Yes.
And they decide just to let him go because they don't want to do the paperwork for it. And then we come back to Tatooine, and the fighter lands in Peli's hangar, and she asks how it was, and Mando replies, wizard.
which is totally wizard.
Which is another episode reference. And then Peli mentions that someone was looking for him, but before Din can get any answers, Fennec Shand calls out, and she's found her way inside Peli's hangar, and then Fennec jumps down and approaches, and she asks if he's looking for work. It's not a bounty. They need muscle. And then Mando says, Boba Fett. Fennec confirms he sure would appreciate it. And then he looks at the money, and then he tosses it back, saying it's on the house. But first, he has to pay a visit to a little friend, and then we cut to black.
Yep. What now, an episode.
I don't think, let's just say this real quick before we talk general things again and kind of end this. I don't think we're going to see Din in the next episode go see Grogu.
No, I don't think that's going to happen either. I think he
doesn't even be in the next episode. He comes back to the finale after seeing Grogu.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. And then we're going to get that off-screen journey in Mando Season 3.
Yes.
Yeah, that's also kind of what I feel. But
I didn't
think we were going to get this much Din in this episode, so you never know.
I was like 100% sure no way Luke Skywalker shows up, but there is a small 15% to 20% chance he might show up at this point because Mandalorian's going to go see him.
Right. I think it would be like more likely that he talks to, you know, he's busy and he talks to somebody else at the Jedi Academy or something.
Plo Koon, who's now alive somehow.
There you go. There you go. Oh, what?
You know that's happening.
That'd be funny.
Just wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Couple things. Yeah. I do want to say, this episode somehow, even though Fennec was in it for 5 seconds, has made me back off the Fennec is going to betray Boba thing because we simply just don't have that much time anymore.
We really don't. She also seemed very genuine that she says he sure would appreciate it was just like, it seemed very genuine to me.
Yeah, she still could, but it feels even less likely now.
Yeah,
and another thing that feels less likely, I think it's just the Pikes.
Yeah,
I think it is just the Pikes at this point, and they might hire out their own muscle, people like Cad Bane.
Yeah, that.
But I don't know about Kira anymore.
Yeah, I could see a tease at the end, like somebody escapes from the final battle. And runs
and
off
to report
to Kira. And
like
almost like how Solo... Exactly. Yeah. How Solo ended.
I could see that. Yeah.
I could see that happening. But I agree. I don't think like we're going to see Boba take on Crimson Dawn in this series anymore.
We just don't have time.
Right. The scope and scale is just not what we thought it was going to be in any regard. Which is great. I love being pleasantly surprised in that. I will say, the rest of the Book of Boba Fett has its work cut out for it now. It's I'm like, I have enjoyed the show so far, but this episode made me...
It's not been The Mandalorian.
It's not been
This episode pointed that out.
Yes, it made me realize just how much I missed The Mandalorian. Like, I haven't had that much fun watching anything in a long time.
Agreed.
You know, so it was the last part of the Book of Boba Fett has a lot to live up to just from that episode, and we'll see how that serves it.
Here's the thing. I know there's some people who, and I'm not saying you're wrong for this, there's some people who are like, this should never have happened in this show because this is the Book of Boba Fett and Boba Fett wasn't even in it. I understand that point.
I really get that criticism.
I just don't care. it's not saying I don't care about your opinion. I just don't care personally. For me, it doesn't matter because at the end of the day, this is my perspective on it. we could have lived in a world where we don't get any of this.
Right.
Where we don't get new Star Wars every week that's live action or even animated. But we do live in a world where we get new Star Wars. And so I'm going to celebrate that, number one.
100%.
But then it was so good.
Yeah.
Like, even if, like, that is a valid criticism, it might be, it might not be. It was just so good. I don't think anybody can deny that. And so if this show has done anything great at the end of the day, it's been this episode.
Yeah.
It gave us this episode, which, like you said, kind of sadly points out some of the weaknesses of the rest of the show so far. Even though I've really enjoyed it, you've really enjoyed it, it's no Mandalorian, and that's okay.
Right. Yeah, and I'm sure someone feels the exact opposite. I'm sure someone was like, oh, the Mandalorian was fine, but like the Book of Boba Fett, that's what I'm about, you know, and that's great.
Exactly,
like,
and that's great.
Yeah, Alex and I often have like very differing opinions. We're just, this is a time where we're pretty pretty on the same board, or pretty on the same page, you know?
Yep. And so, like, another thing that I want to say before we close out here, don't let anybody, especially if you really love something, don't let anybody tell you you shouldn't love that thing.
Right.
And I'm talking about Star Wars here, but I mean, I guess in a broader sense, that could work too. But like, I'm talking about like, so for example, when I saw The Last Jedi, I loved it.
Yeah.
Then I came out, I still loved it, I was buzzing about it, but then I saw the discourse about it, and I was like, should I not love it? There's a lot of people saying I shouldn't love this thing. Now, there were some things that I did not like about it in it, like Luke dying. I didn't like that he died, of course, but I loved it overall. And so, like, I was at a point in my fandom where it's like, well, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe those people are right. Guys, love what you love, and if you don't, that's okay. Find something that you do and celebrate that. That's what we're all about on this podcast. Find the things that you can, and don't watch it with a cynical eye.
Right.
Don't watch it to find things that you hate, because that's got to be miserable.
It's so, so exhausting. It's exhausting for anyone else to listen to, and it's got to be exhausting for you too. You know?
Right. So I loved it. I hope everyone loved it. And if you didn't, I'm sorry. And I hope this episode helped you love it a little bit more. And this was just incredible. I think the voicemails are going to be all time again.
Voicemails are going to be off the chain this week.
Last week was incredible.
Right. If there is a week to sign up to the Patreon just to get that extra voicemail episode, this is the week.
This is it. By the way, because we met a goal, we have to watch the first Ewok movie. Neither of us have actually watched the Ewok movies at all, so now we've got to watch and do a commentary for the Patreon because we met a goal.
So we have the first Ewok movie in our future, which
it's
is
very
great.
Exciting.
I'm excited to experience a new piece of media. I hope it will deepen my love for Star Wars.
We'll find something we love about it.
100%.
100%. All right. Well, I think that about does it. Any last thoughts, Mac?
We've talked plenty. We've gone like
it's
an hour. I was looking. We were still on like the second scene at like the 45-minute mark. So thank you guys for sticking with us. But just had way too much to say on this one. So many cool things that we got and so many amazing things coming down the pipe, you know, that this alluded to. So, yeah, I think that's all I've got to say on the matter, unless there's anything you want to add, Alex.
I've got one thing to say.
What's that?
This is the way.
This is the way. Until next time, keep the watch.